From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Comic writer and director Neil Brennan didn't get seriously into stand-up until the series he co-created and co-wrote, Chappelle's Show, abruptly ended when Dave Chappelle left the country.
The way Chappelle's Show ended, I just felt, you know, bereft, and I felt like I need to be more self-determining, and the most self-determining thing you can do in comedy is just do stand-up.
We'll talk about Brennan's career in comedy, his experiences with clinical depression, and his relationship with his father, an abusive, alcoholic narcissist.
In true narcissistic fashion, when my father was diagnosed, he called us all up to tell us. He was like, "Are you sitting down? I have some news. I'm a narcissist." It was somehow affirming to him. Like, I knew it. I knew I thought I was great.
Also, Justin Chang reviews the new film Berlin Syndrome. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, comic Neil Brennan, is mostly known for being a behind-the-scenes guy. With Dave Chappelle, he co-created and co-wrote the sketch comedy series Chappelle's Show. And he co-wrote a sketch for Saturday Night Live when Chappelle hosted just after Donald Trump was elected president. Brennan also has directed episodes of Inside Amy Schumer and wrote some material for Seth Meyers for his 2011 performance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Earlier this year, Brennan wrote for The Daily Show on Comedy Central, but Brennan has begun stepping out more as a performer. In February, when Terry spoke with him, he had recently released a comedy special on Netflix, which is still available for streaming. It's called Three Mics, and he literally works with three different microphones. One mic is for his one-liners, one is for stand-up, and one is for his personal stories about things like depression and his family. Let's hear a clip from the stand-up section.
I hang out with a lot of black dudes. Yeah, white people are always like, what's it like? It's like, we don't do anything crazy. We just, like, eat and talk. Like, I don't have to rap. Let's play a game called Sounds Racist, Isn't Racist. Ready? Such a horrible setup for a white person to give. No, here it is. There have been a lot of good slave movies lately, right? Sounds racist. I just enjoy them as movies. You guys think I'm, like, think it's a documentary. I get it. Here's what I've learned hanging out with black dudes. When a new slave movie comes out, can't be your idea as the white person to go see it. Can't be like, have I got a movie for us? Follow me. Hi, could I get 14 for Django, please? Thank you. Slavery is such a big deal. It's such a big deal. If I were black, I would talk about it constantly. I really would. And a lot of white people go, well, I think black people talk about slavery too much as it is. First of all, if Italians went through slavery, they'd never shut the up about it, you know that. You know it. And they'd all have some heroic story of escape, too. Like, so finally, my Uncle Fabrizio was like, he wants a slave master. And he walked from North Carolina straight to Jersey. All right. I would talk about it constantly. Constantly. Like, if I were black and waiting tables, I'd be like, all right, guys, here's your check, and don't forget, slavery. If a cop saw me, he's like, you know why I pulled you over? I'd be like, to apologize for slavery.
Neil Brennan, welcome to Fresh Air. So one of your mics on the three mics is for, like, autobiographical stories. Some of them are, you know, pretty sad about your life and
Thank you. Family.
Yes, you're welcome. So was that a way of saying to people, look, there's three mics. There's one for stand-up. There's one for, like, one-liners. And then there's one for, like, more serious stuff. Don't expect the big laughs from the more serious. Like, don't start heckling me because I'm telling you, like, more personal stories. Like, I'm on that mic. I'm on that, the mic set aside for that. We'll get back to the one-liners.
Yeah, it's expressly for serious stuff. And I found a lot of people start liking it more than the stand-up, which is kind of insulting. But but they like it. More. Like, they start to kind of you build up you metabolize it in a certain way, and then you're like, I can't wait to get to the sad stuff.
So in your show, you're the guy on stage, you're the guy behind the mic or the mics, but really, yeah. you had become best known for being a behind the scenes guy, directing Amy Schumer's show. Writing for Chappelle's show. I want to ask you about writing with him for the show. You co-created the show as well as co-writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the sketches were about race. And so you were like the white person writing from a black point of view. Were there times it was uncomfortable to be a white person writing sketches from a black point of view in the sense that there's always comedy you're allowed to do, for instance, about Jews, but only if you're Jewish? Or about gay people, but only if you're gay. Or about black people, but only if you're black. I could go on.
No, please do. What else? I mean, there was never... it wasn't too awkward because it was just me and him. It was more just like pitching jokes. Like, hey, how about this? How about this? You want to do this? You want to do that? It was never... I would never take big swings in terms of racial jokes. Like, you know, hey, you know, black people do this. It was never that sort of bald. It was more like a premise, and then we would sort of know. And a lot of what we did was make fun of white people's perception of black people. So I think in some ways I was a benefit that I could sort of not explain, like, you know, white people see this, but there were certain things that I could maybe express, not like Dave wouldn't know, but I could maybe verify. So it was never too awkward.
Can you think of an example of it?
I'm thinking, the ones I'm thinking of are so broad and they're not even good jokes. Like, I don't like to, we had a deal where we wouldn't say who wrote what, but there's some jokes that are just like, who cares? We did a racial draft sketch when Tiger Woods gets drafted.
You have to explain the premise.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. So we did a racial draft where different racial groups draft people that are sort of in between. So Tiger Woods is half Asian and half black. So basically he gets adopted by black people. He gets drafted by black people and now he's officially black. And we did a bunch of them, like the Wu-Tang Clan got drafted by Asians, a bunch of things like that. I think Colin Powell got drafted by white people.
Yes,
I think.
only if they took Condoleezza Rice too.
That's correct. So I was like, Dave was like, hey, I need, what should I say as Tiger Woods? And I was like, I don't know, goodbye fried rice, hello fried chicken. It's like, and it's a decent joke, but it's not anything I'm especially proud of, but it got the job done. It was like a Band-Aid line.
So you were actually on Chappelle's show in a position that a lot of black people are in, which is being the minority person. You
know, yeah.
You were the white person working with Chappelle and with a, you know, largely black cast, hanging out with a lot of fellow comics who are largely African-American. And I should mention here, your podcast, Champs, only mm-hmm. has on comics of color.
Yes, for the most part, yeah. And a few, it wasn't all black people, but we had a no white people policy.
So I've asked a lot of African-Americans over the years what it's like to be like the black person who's like integrating the school, or, you mm-hmm. know, the only black person in their class, or the only black person on the job, or the only black writer on the show. So let me ask you the reverse question. What was it like being like the white guy?
It was very hard. No, it was great. It was never, there's such a thing as being a minority, but not being oppressed. I was a minority with power, I guess. I was a minority, but I was still the number two guy. So I never felt like, I never felt oppressed. I think my whole goal was just to do right by Dave, because I was thankful for the opportunity, and to do right by black people at large, I think, vis-a-vis Dave.
So you also got to be the man directing Amy Schumer's show, because you directed, what, like 10 episodes?
Yeah, the first season.
And there's so much real, like, girl and feminist stuff on that show. Did you feel like you learned things about women by doing that show?
Well, yeah, the thing that I always say about Schumer's show is that the way that the Chappelle show was about the horror of being a black man, Schumer's show was about the horror of being a woman. The day-to-day inconvenience, you know, it's like, what's it like to have a world-class intellect in a world where you're treated like a third-class citizen? And that applies to Amy and Dave. It's like, Dave's smarter than everyone he talks to, and yet has to, and it is routinely spoken down to by merit of being black. Maybe less so now that he's famous, but as it was, you know, before he was famous, it was always this ongoing condescension, which I think women have to deal with on an hourly basis as well. And Amy being a great example of that. And maybe because she's famous now, there's less talking down to, but there's still a ton of it in both their cases.
All right. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Neil Brennan. He's a comic writer and director. He has a Netflix comedy special that's called Three Mics. That's as in microphone. And he was the co-creator of Chappelle's Show. He directed a bunch of episodes of Amy Schumer's show. He's written for Saturday Night Live. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is comic, writer, and director Neil Brennan, and he has a Netflix comedy special called Three Mics, mics as in microphones. One mic is for one-liners, one mic is for stand-up, and one mic is for his autobiographical monologues, which include stories about depression and his family. He also co-created Chappelle's Show and directed episodes of Inside Amy Schumer. Let's get back to Three Mics. You talk about depression in your show. At what age did you become aware that other people weren't feeling what you were feeling, that you were sadder than other people? You had a problem most people did not.
It's a good question. You know, when I was a kid, I used to cry every day. Like when I was like, you know, 7 through 11 or 6 through 11, to the point where my brothers and sisters would like, there was an ongoing joke where they would make me cry to keep my streak alive of crying every day. yeah, pretty great. So I think that's probably an indicator. It never occurred to me like, you know, this is clinical depression. And I don't even know if it was. I maybe just was a sensitive little kid. But I think probably once I was like an adult and you sort of realize like, oh, this isn't just like an attitude. This is actual, there may be something clinically happening here. And I think I started taking medication when I was 24.
You describe depression as being like a virus that attacks your brain with negative thoughts. And you also said, like, to say I had low self-esteem isn't true. I had no self-esteem. So it must be hard to decide to get on stage when you feel like you have no self-esteem.
Yeah, it is hard, but it's also like a Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a, like, well, screw it. Let me see if this works. Let me see if, like, you know, gale force approval works. And a lot of times it does, you know? I mean, that's the truth. It doesn't last long. It is a bit of a sieve where it's hard to bank good feelings or approval, but it certainly is a short-term fix, getting approval from an audience.
Does it feel better when you're on stage delivering it yourself than when you've written it for somebody else and they're getting the laugh?
Yeah, it's definitely more direct. You know, I liken it to when you write a joke for somebody else, it's like you know, like the Wile E. Coyote dynamite plunger, where he pushes the plunger down and then you see the fuse go and then there's an explosion in the distance. That's like writing a joke for somebody. When you tell the joke, you're in the explosion and you get all that approval for yourself, Terry.
So you know a lot of comics, and a lot of comics have depression. Mm-hmm. So do you have a theory of why that's so?
Comedy is almost like the valve, you know? So you're like desperately trying to feel better, and I think you'll like think in different ways, you'll think in unique ways, and that will beget comedy because it's this desperation to feel a little bit better. There's also the theory which Chris Rock has mentioned when we was talking about Robin Williams. He said, you know, if ignorance is bliss, you know, then consciousness can be miserable. You know, like real paying attention and real observation and deep thought and deep consideration can be a bit, you know, miserable making.
Well, that's the thing about really good comics is like you guys see beneath the surface of things and have the verbal facility and irony and comedy to kind of turn that into something that everybody gets and can,
yeah,
at least a lot of people get and can identify with, and plus you can make it funny, so there's a moment of relief for everybody listening.
Yeah, it's like I've gone to the netherworld and I brought back this, you know?
Right.
I brought back this nugget of thought or comedy or whatever.
So you're the youngest of 10 siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about this in your show, Three Mics. Your father was abusive. He was violent. He was an alcoholic. What kind of drunk was he?
He wasn't like a 10 drink guy. He was a three drink guy every day, and they would sort of give him and then he would felt deputized to kind of rage or be vitriolic. I think it gave him the confidence to sort of let out his true self, which was kind of nasty and competitive and petty. I think that's more, it was never like fall down, stumbling, slurring drunk. It was just more like bullying drunk.
Did watching your father be a mean drunk affect how you felt about starting to drink? You know,
yeah, like I drank a lot in high school. Yeah. Yeah, no, I drank a lot in high school, mostly just to like, I guess just to like fit in. But I've maybe gotten drunk 3 times in my adult life, twice maybe. Like I can count. I just don't, it just doesn't do anything for me. Like I, A, like my personality, and B, I need energy. I don't need a depressant.
So, if your father became very insulting when he got drunk, and he got drunk a lot, did he insult you a lot? And did he insult you colorfully? Like, were they interesting insults or just mean ones?
My father was sort of, a lot of what he, I think a lot of his, the things he said were sort of stolen from, like, Frank Sinatra records. I remember hearing a live Frank Sinatra live from the Mirage or some Vegas show and going like, oh, this is like where my dad's sort of style came from. You see it actually with Donald Trump too, like where he, you can see like he believes in that like sort of rat packy. Donald Trump, like you look at his press conference, he's just emceeing, like he's kind of doing like a rat pack thing where he's kind of insulting people and a bit like Don Ricklesy. So I think generationally, like my father, were he alive, he'd be 80. My dad would be 87 now. So he's older than Donald Trump. But yeah, like that was sort of their paradigm of cool and funny, was that kind of like rat packy thing. He would get in on that crying thing. I remember him saying I'd be on the Olympic crying team, which is not a great joke, but I think he thought it was funny. So it was just like, you know, kind of a cool little snap. But, you know, I was because I was the youngest, I was kind of like the mascot of the family. I was precocious. I was kind of cute. I had a bob haircut. And so I think my father, there was like a grudging respect he had for me because my brothers and sisters were all nice to me. And I think I was sort of considered wise and intelligent from a fairly young age. So I think I was a bit of like the opposition leader. Like, he knew I was against him. He knew I didn't approve of him, but I think he had to kind of respect me because he knew I was fairly intelligent.
In your autobiographical monologues in your show Three Mics, you describe your father as a narcissist. Was that your diagnosis?
No, that was a doctor's diagnosis. In true narcissistic fashion, when my father was diagnosed as a narcissist, he called us all up individually to tell us. And he did it with true pride. Like, he was like, hey, I have some, are you sitting down? I have some news. I'm a narcissist. So it was like, incredibly ironic. But yeah, he was a proud narcissist. I think he liked it. I think it made him feel like confident in himself. Like, I think he was like, it was somehow affirming to him that like, I knew it. I knew I thought I was great. If that makes sense.
So what does it mean in the official lexicon of psychiatry that you're a narcissist, when you're a narcissist?
I think he, you know, my understanding is no empathy. And every single thing is about how it affects you. And every single situation is about you.
Okay. So your father was the father of 10 children, you being
yes.
the youngest.
Ten people who were not him. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. That must be a challenge. Like, you're supposed to have empathy with your children. You're supposed to really care about them, even put them before you many times.
Yeah.
So yeah. It sounds like your father would not.
That's
be
what I've heard. Yes.
Sounds like your father was not doing that when he was raising you.
Yeah, he was not. He was not an empathetic guy, and he was not. He didn't want to have kids. I think ultimately, like, he just didn't want to have kids. I think that's another thing that you weren't even allowed to really admit or acknowledge or live a life based on. Like, you couldn't say, I don't want kids, I don't think. Like, I think most of their my mother and father's life was just like, what's everybody else doing? I guess that's what we have to do. I think my mother was happy to do it. I think my mom loved having 10 kids, but I think my dad hated it. Really, I really think he just didn't like it. And he was kind of stuck, you know, which, you know, is it, he, that's how he behaved.
How did that leave you feeling about having children yourself?
Well, Terry, I don't have any. So I think it's pretty clear how it left me feeling. My brother Kevin used to do a joke where he said, like, yeah, I'm from a big family. I know how that ends. Like, he didn't want to have kids. He now has two kids. But yeah, like, it doesn't, it's not, I don't know. I'm not curious. It wasn't, yeah, I don't know. I think it's the same way alcohol affected me. I think I'm having a similar, I had a similar response to children. Even though I was the youngest, so I can't say, like, oh, it was awful. And it was fun in a lot of ways. But I never had, like, a little, I never got to see, like, a baby grow up or anything like that. It's never occurred to me to have children or to want children.
Comedian and writer Neil Brennan speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. After a break, he'll talk about working with Dave Chappelle to create and write Chappelle's Show and what it was like when Dave Chappelle abruptly left that comedy series. And film critic Justin Chang reviews the new movie Berlin Syndrome. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Squarespace, where customers can get a Squarespace domain and showcase their creative ideas with a website, portfolio, or online store. Learn more at squarespace.com. And from Magoosh, online test prep for exams such as the GRE, GMAT, and MCAT. More at magoosh.com. Magoosh, prep smart, go far, enjoy the ride.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's interview from February with comic, writer, and director Neil Brennan. With Dave Chappelle, he co-founded and co-wrote the sketch comedy series Chappelle's Show. He's directed episodes of Inside Amy Schumer, and earlier this year, he worked on The Daily Show and released a solo comedy special on Netflix, which is still available to view. It's called Three Mics. Because on stage in the show, he uses three different microphones, one for one-liners, one for stand-up, and one for stories about his life, including stories about dealing with clinical depression and growing up with a father who was an abusive alcoholic.
In your show, you talk about how you say to your father when he was sick, before he died, you say to him, I feel like you didn't love us, your children. And your father thinks about it and says, yeah, I didn't. What do you do with that? What do you do with your father actually telling you that what you suspected is true, that he didn't really love his children?
It felt good because it was clarifying. It was like finding the solution to the mystery. Everyone would always say, I would say, like, I don't think my dad loves me. And people would go, like, of course your dad loves you. He's your dad. Of course he does. And I'd be like, no, I'm pretty sure he doesn't. And so for him to say, like, I didn't love you guys was liberating because I was like, okay, great. I'm not crazy. Because you always feel like you're crazy when you have a parent like that. And what I've found from talking about in the show is there's a lot of that going around, that where people don't feel loved by their parents. And they're like, it's not just not feeling it. It's you don't feel it because it's not there. It's a line I forgot to do in the show, which is like, I said, like, love's like elemental. Like it's, it's like wind or heat or something where you can just feel it, you know, like you can feel when someone loves you. And that's a thing, a feeling I just never got from my father. And people have been super grateful that I just said it in public, because a lot of people feel that way and no one ever really says it. So it was, while it was painful, it was way more illuminating than it was painful.
So when your father told you, yeah, I didn't love you, was that like past tense? Like, I didn't love you then. I wasn't really prepared to be the father of 10. But now I really appreciate you and love you.
No, Terry, there was no addendum. it was a full sentence. I didn't love you, period. Now, where were we? And then we just, you know what I mean? Like, there was no, about this weather. There was no... It wasn't a paragraph. It was a full sentence, and then it was on to the next thing.
I'm assuming you're okay with me laughing about this.
No, yeah, I, of
easy
course,
for me
yeah.
to laugh at your jokes about your father not loving you.
Yeah, no, it is funny. It's funny. Like, I mean, it's awful, but it's funny.
Okay. So, early when you were, I don't know, in your teens or 20s, I assume this was after you dropped out of film school. Mm-hmm. You worked the door at a comedy club in Greenwich Village.
Yes.
So you must have met a lot of comics doing that. I think that's how you met Chappelle, right?
Yeah, that is how I met Dave. But yeah, the average, I mean, this is in the early 90s, so the average, you know, Jon Stewart was around, Ray Romano was around, Louie was around, Dave Attell was around, Chappelle. That was like an average show back then, but none of them were famous.
So how, when you met Chappelle, what clicked and got you working together?
Well, we were the only young guys. We were like both 17 or 18. So I think we had a shared sensibility in terms of like, whereas I'd gone to film school, we just had similar taste in movies and like what we liked or what we didn't, or things that we thought were hacky or things that we thought were like done to death or whatever. And we would just talk and we'd like walk around for hours.
And you did a movie together that didn't do well, and then
yes.
went your own separate ways, and then got back together for a Chappelle show. You co-created it with him. What does that mean? Came up with the premise together?
Yeah, basically, we pitched a pilot to HBO and Comedy Central. HBO looked at us like we were like out of our minds, and then we pitched to Comedy Central. They bought it, but we basically just pitched like it was sort of the idea was like a joke book come to life. So we would do any sort of idea either one of us had. Dave always called it a joke dispenser. So it's figuring out just like we had a point, what's the best way to illustrate that point? When we did the pilot, there was no audience. And we did the bloopers from Roots that was in the pilot. We did the Kinko's / Pop Copy training video. And I think we did the reparations news thing. And when we went to series, we decided to do it in front of an audience, and which was a great, great way to do it.
My guest is Neil Brennan, who co-created Chappelle's Show. Let's hear a clip from Chappelle's Show. This is a sketch in which Dave Chappelle hosts a game show called I Know Black People, in which the contestants are drawn from different groups, white, Asian, black. Each contestant claims to know a lot about black people. We'll hear Chappelle introduce the panelists and then ask each of them a question.
I know black people!
Welcome to the show, I Know Black People. We take contestants who claim to know black people and put their knowledge of African-American culture to the test. The contestant who answers the most questions, of course, wins our grand prize. Let's bring them out one at a time now. Our first contestant is a professor of African American studies and history at Fordham University, the New York City police officer, is a writer for such black television shows as The Chris Rock Show and Chappelle's Show. Okay, our next contestant works in a Korean grocery store, is a DJ, and claims to have many black friends. A social worker in Wilmington, Delaware. The barber in Brooklyn who claims that 100% of his clients are black. Let's play the game. How can black people rise up and overcome?
How can they rise up and overcome? Well, can they? No.
That is correct.
Reparations.
That is acceptable.
This is a rap lyric?
No, this is, I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a general question.
This is an actual question.
All right. There's a complex answer there.
That is correct.
Staying alive.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, stop cutting each other's throat.
That also is correct. How can black people rise up and overcome?
Get out and vote.
That is incorrect.
I'll talk more about Chappelle's Show, as well as other things, with comic, writer, and director Neil Brennan after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Zillow with the Zestimate to give users a starting point to calculate their home's value and help them gauge the past, present, and future market value of their home or other homes in their neighborhood. Zillow, find your way home. And from Angie's List, who believes home is where people should always fit in. With over 20 years of reviews for hiring local pros, Angie's List is committed to making every homeowner a little smarter. More at angieslist.com. Home is where our heart is.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with comic writer and director Neil Brennan. He has a new Netflix comedy special called Three Mics. With Dave Chappelle, he co-created and co-wrote the sketch comedy series Chappelle's Show. You had an agreement with Chappelle not to divulge who wrote what.
Yeah.
Why was
Except
that important
for the,
to you both?
Goodbye, hello, fried chicken joke.
Right. yeah.
That masterpiece. It was important. I knew from writing the movie that didn't do well called Half-Baked, that didn't do well in the box office, but like it's still popular. I knew when we wrote together that he would get all the credit in comedy and I would get all the credit in showbiz. So like in comedy clubs, it would be like someone's referred to me as Dave's typist in the past. That he would get all the credit because he was a really well-known comedian, and I would get all the credit in showbiz because I was the white had to do with it. I was a white person, so therefore they're predisposed to give me credit over a black guy. And I was also like the writer, and the in LA, the writer is like the sort of organized taskmaster and the one who organizes the talent's voice, Dave being the talent. Because people don't want to believe that you're both talented. They want to believe that there's this simple explanation of like Neil's Dave's typist or Dave's this crazy genius that Neil types for, or Neil is this puppet master who is telling Dave what to say and how to say it and where to say it. And both are insulting. So I was like, let's just keep it anonymous so that people can't, you know, kind of divide and conquer. And It's just a respect thing. It's like, how do I keep my respect and how do I keep it so that Dave gets respect?
So since so many sketches were about race, did you and Chappelle have a lot of like deep discussions about race?
Yeah, but the thing is we'd been having them. We'd been having them since 1992, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew him when the Rodney King verdict came out. I knew him when the OJ verdict came out. Like I had dinner with him the night the OJ verdict came out. I remember when Rodney King happened, he was in L.A. I remember talking to him like that day or the next day. So we'd been having long, deep discussions and that were kind of ongoing. Like there were sketches we did Like, we did a real world sketch, and that's a discussion we'd been having for 8 years by that point, how black people are portrayed on certain reality shows. So these were it wasn't like, oh, we have a show, we better talk about race. Dave's wife at one point said, all you and Neil talk about is girls and work, work being race in this case. Like, that's kind of all we would ever talk about. We're sort of gender and race. So it was a natural extension of an ongoing conversation.
No, my impression from things I read was that Chappelle at some point thought that white people were misinterpreting the sketches and maybe sometimes like laughing at him instead of with him on certain things. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard when something goes out to that broad an audience. You can't control what people make of it. The most troublesome example of this was me and Dave were in, I think, Tempe, Arizona, and we were at a nightclub, and some sort of dusty white dude came up and was like, "Hey, man, I like that sketch about the blind white supremacist who leaves his wife because she's a lover." And it was just like, ugh, like literally, like even just saying it just now, my like, I get the chills. It so makes me so uncomfortable. And it's one of those things where it's like, so what do you do? Do you stop? You can't control how people interpret things.
Right. And the sketch that you're talking about was about a blind white supremacist who, because he's blind, doesn't realize he's actually black.
Yes. So he's eviscerating.
He's assaulting his himself without realizing it.
Yes, exactly. He's black and then leaves his wife because she likes black people.
Right. The larger thing here is that, like, people who are racist are stupid. They're not seeing.
Yeah, exactly. And sure enough, that's what happened. So there were a few things like that where it's like, you know, what do you do if you're a black artist? And I think a lot of black artists reckon with this, is like, what do you do? Do you just keep doing your thing and accept that there's going to be a certain amount of the audience that doesn't understand what you're doing at all? Or do you kind of fold it up and go, if you don't, this is too important for you to misinterpret, so I can't risk it, you know? Which in some ways is, I think, the path that Dave took, which is like, I can't deal with this misinterpretation. It means too much to me, and it's too painful.
Do you think that's why he kind of left the show and went to South Africa?
Yeah, I think so. I think I think it was like a lot of stuff, but I think that was one of them, yeah. Because he went to South Africa, because he went to Africa and there was a white person, I think I got labeled as that white person. And it was like, no, we were writing sketches the day before. We were fine. Like, we were getting along fine. There was no racial tension between us. But that was a tough situation for me emotionally, too. Me doing co-creating a show and then the show just dissolving in a day.
Well, he didn't tell you he was leaving, right?
No, he didn't. And I was on set waiting for him when I found out he was in Africa. I didn't know he was gone until he was gone.
That must have been very strange for you to have something so abrupt and so important. I mean, it was a long friendship.
Yeah, it was painful on a lot of levels. It was painful in that... this thing that I made with him was now... I knew when he was gone that the show was over. It wasn't like, oh, he'll come back. Then I just knew, like, okay, that's like... I know what that means. It was painful on a personal level. It had been painful before then, but it wasn't... it wasn't, like, racially painful. It was just painful. It was kind of personally painful. In that when we had to renegotiate with Comedy Central, it was basically a divide and conquer thing. And we were divided and conquered. I think I was conquered. I think there was some contractual stuff that was really painful. And that was more, that was the going to Africa thing was just like the final nail in the coffin.
You had said for a long time that you might become friends again, but you'd probably never work together again. But right after the election, when Chappelle hosted Saturday Night Live, you wrote one of the sketches. So how did you get to work with him again on Saturday Night Live?
Well, we'd been friends. And, you know, when I did three mics, he was very supportive. He came when I did it in Montreal. He came when I did it in L.A. And then he came to the opening in New York. And I was grateful because it's, you know, I think because of the way Chappelle Show ended, I get branded as kind of either racist or I'm a jerk to Dave or all this stuff. And it's like, no, me and Dave, like, so these, like, Dave's fans would be sort of, had sort of a bad feeling about me. And I think by him coming to the show and getting his picture taken with me and all this stuff and sort of endorsing it, it was sort of like, hey, just so you know, me and Neil are cool and we've been cool. So I was grateful for that. And then when he was hosting Saturday Night Live, he, you know, asked me to help. And I was, I want to see him do well. And the way that that sketch came about was, it was the week of the election. So on Wednesday, I came in to write a sketch with Colin Jost. And we wrote, at like noon, we wrote the election night sketch that Chris Rock ended up being in. And it was... And it was a. It turned out to be a good sketch.
This is a sketch where everybody's watching TV on election night, and they're rooting for Hillary, and she's losing state by state. And they keep thinking, well, if she just wins Pennsylvania, all she has to do is win Ohio. And
yeah, which
and,
was
and their,
kind
their
of what we were all
dashed.
Doing.
Yeah,
yeah. Which was I literally said the line because me and Jost were on some kind of conference call at 5:30 on Tuesday of election day. 5:30 in the afternoon, and Frank Luntz said that Hillary was going to win by 5. So we were like, okay. So we get off the call, and I go, yeah, you know, there may never be another Republican president based on Democrat. Like, literally, just saying things I'd read in The Atlantic, you know, just being like a liberal white stereotype. And then so then the next day, we put all that sort of stupidity into the sketch, or the naivete, I'd say, is what it was.
And you gave it a really interesting racial edge, too. Would you explain?
Oh, yeah. Well, that actually came from Dave. So we, in the first draft that we read at Read Through that me and Jost wrote that afternoon, it was kind of Dave just being kind of playing devil's advocate. Like, really? That's your worst case scenario? Just sort of like, and then he, after Read Through, Dave was like, just make it a little bit like blacker. And then Chris signed on, I think like on Thursday or Friday, he said he'd do it. So then we added some lines for him when he got there Saturday. And so, yeah, so it turned out it worked out well.
And the kind of bottom line of the sketch, in a way, is if you think that Donald Trump winning and Hillary losing is the worst thing that's ever happened to this country.
Yeah. No, it's the,
implicit
this is the
in
most
that
shameful.
Was like, let's remember slavery for a moment.
There's a few slavery references, like where there's a thing where Dave says, like, yeah, I remember my grandfather telling me that. He was a slave. Yeah, like sort of like reminding white people, like, no, this is like the... There's this thing of like, this isn't America. It's like, I don't know. I think this is America. Like, we counted the votes and this is America.
Well, Neil Brennan, thank you so much for talking with us. I really
enjoyed
it.
Terry, like I said, couldn't be a bigger fan. This is like a dream come true. So I really, really appreciate you having me on.
Comic and writer Neil Brennan speaking to Terry Gross in February. His stand-up comedy special, Three Mics, is available on Netflix. That's Mics, spelled M-I-C-S, as in microphones. Coming up, Justin Chang reviews the new Australian film, Berlin Syndrome. I'm David B. Inculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The new film Berlin Syndrome by the Australian director Kate Shortland stars Teresa Palmer as an Australian woman traveling abroad who suddenly finds herself taken captive by a mysterious stranger. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
The title Berlin Syndrome is a sly riff on Stockholm Syndrome, that condition in which a hostage begins to feel sympathy for her captor. It's never clear what sets the Berlin version apart, and in some ways, the director Kate Shortland and the screenwriter Sean Grant seem to be figuring it out as they go along. That's not a knock. Berlin Syndrome might look on the surface like a polished B-movie, a crafty and violent tale of a woman in captivity. But it's also the rare psychological thriller that feels not just taut and gripping, but genuinely exploratory. It nudges an overworked subgenre into fascinatingly unresolved territory. Teresa Palmer plays Claire, a young Australian photographer who has just arrived in Berlin as the movie opens. She spends her nights in a hostel and her days wandering around the city, snapping pictures of buildings, with a particularly fond eye for Cold War-era architecture. She looks lonely and somewhat forlorn, but also open to the thrill of a new experience. And she gets one when she meets Andy, played by Max Remelt, a friendly schoolteacher with Ryan Gosling good looks and a talent for mangling the English language in the most charming way possible. Claire, who has just been thinking about moving on to Dresden, puts her plans on hold and spends a night at Andy's place. The love scene that ensues is passionate and raw, but also faintly ominous. Claire is too lost in her pleasure to notice that none of the windows in Andy's apartment open, or that the whole building seems suspiciously vacant. The next morning, Andy goes off to work, and Claire finds herself locked in. She chalks it up to a silly misunderstanding. One of the most unnerving things about Berlin Syndrome is its eerie sense of modulation, the way it takes its time confirming Claire's worst fears. Even after Andy returns home later that evening, she doesn't realize that her hot one-night stand is a serial creep who has no intention of letting her leave.
Couldn't find the key. Did you leave me a key?
Yes. Sure. I thought I left it on the table.
Nope. I didn't think I'd be able to get back in, and then I realized that I couldn't even leave.
Hey, you can leave now. I take a shower.
Did you lock me in?
Yes, sure. But next time, I'll tie you to the bed.
She thinks he's kidding, but he isn't. Shortland is a masterful director of action, and her set pieces leave you duly gasping for air. Claire's first escape attempt, involving a jigsaw puzzle and a well-placed screwdriver, is a perfect balance of squirmy buildup and gory release. But the mechanics of suspense interest Shortland only so much. What she has fashioned here is a dual character study, in which her attention, if not her sympathy, is distributed evenly between predator and prey. Remelt scrupulously avoids even a hint of over-the-top villainy, and he's in no hurry to give up his character's secrets. But there are telling clues nonetheless. The movie follows Andy as he visits his father, teaches his classes, and awkwardly tries to engage with his co-workers. Andy's hang-ups have a way of emerging in random conversation. At one point, he chats up another woman on the street, eyeing her as a possible replacement for Claire. He's clearly done this all before. What makes Berlin Syndrome so compelling and keeps it from devolving into a leering exploitation movie is that Claire is even more fascinating than her captor. Palmer plays her character as not just a heroine, but an enigma. While we learn an awful lot about what makes Andy tick, Claire's own backstory remains something of a blank. There are no flashbacks, no insights into what might have motivated her to move around the world, or what she might even be fleeing. As days become weeks, and weeks become months, Claire retreats into her own private madness. We're never entirely sure what to make of her relationship with Andy, or the fragile layers of trust and affection that seem to develop between them. Has Claire resigned herself to her fate? Or is she just playing one very long mind game? As it patiently untangles that mystery, Berlin Syndrome occasionally loses its narrative momentum, particularly toward the end, as one brutal climax follows another. But the underlying tension never goes slack. We remain a captive audience to the end.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. On Monday's show, we'll listen back to one of our favorite programs from our archives, a studio performance by and interview with Dion, one of the great singers who started in the doo-wop era. His hits included Runaround Sue, I Wonder Why, and The Wanderer. A new collection of folk rock songs he recorded in 1965 has just come out. Many of those songs were unreleased until now. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inclu.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Whole Foods Market, offering drinks, snacks, and grilling staples. Recipes for Memorial Day meals are available at WholeFoodsMarket.com. Whole Foods Market, we believe in real food. And from Audible, dedicated to being a source for immersive storytelling experiences, featuring celebrity performances and original content. Membership information and more is at Audible.com.